as we go in the interest of time. It's.
Okay. All right. Thank you for joining us for the August session of the 2014 Geriatric Mental Health Series, Early Stage Dementia, Engaging the Family, which is going to be presented by Dr. Keston Blandon. Program sponsored by the Northern New England Geriatric Education Center. Our activities are funded by the Health Resources and Services Administration. This funding allows us to offer this program free charge. Our work is to enhance the care of older adults by offering a comprehensive interdisciplinary education program targeted to the healthcare workforce and besides evidence-based best practices in geriatric care. Mike, would you mind muting? I think we can hear you. In order to receive educational credit for this program, you must be signed in legibly, so please be sure to, that you sign the attendance sheet if you're at a remote site. If we can't read your handwriting, we cannot award you credit. If you're watching online, you need to complete a form online very soon after the program. If you knew how to access this today, you probably have that link, but if not, email geriatric.ed@dartmouth.edu. or call 653-3443 for information on that. And you should have received a form that tells you how to obtain your continuing education credits or contact hours online. Please keep that sheet so you can refer to it later. If you have any cell phones or pagers, please silence them now if you haven't already. At any remote sites, which are being connected in now, your audio should be muted. If you have a question, please unmute your audio and get the speaker's attention. None of the planning committee members for this series, including today's speaker, have any influencing financial relationships to disclose, and there will be no off-label uses discussed. Keston Blandon completed her PhD in psychology at Pacifica Graduate Institute in Santa Barbara, California in 2011. She works in psychosocial research for the Dartmouth Centers for Health and Aging, including telehealth, counseling, and education interventions in dementia. And she's program coordinator for the Alzheimer's Association of Massachusetts and New Hampshire. From her office in the Aging Resource Center, Dr. Blandon provides clinical consultations to individuals and families living with dementia and to professionals. And she designs and runs various education programs on topics within dementia at the center and conducts professional trainings. So just a reminder, if everyone can mute, that would be great. So, this from you. Yeah.
Okay. Everyone's muted. Thank you. So as Laura said, I'm a psychologist. I work specifically with people in dementia. Hi. We've just started. I'm a clinician. I'm an educator, and I'm a researcher. And today I'm talking about specifically about the early stage, and I'll go through what that is, my working definition of it and what we're talking about, and engaging both the patient, the person with dementia, and the family by understanding what their experiences are and what they need from us. And early stage is not talked about as much as the other stages. It's an emerging topic in clinical practice and particularly in research. The other stages are very well known. The advanced stages and the moderate stages, particularly, neuropsychiatric symptoms and non-pharmacological behavioral interventions, and these things are talked about a lot, which is necessary. Early stage, not so much, just because it's just emerging. We're starting to see a lot more of public conversation around this, so we're getting a lot more conversation among older adults. The people that work with older adults, but also just in public awareness and in the media. We're getting more and more public conversation around dementia and Alzheimer's disease. And so we're getting earlier and earlier diagnoses, and we're just starting to really get a handle in research and clinical practice on what are the particulars and the specific issues in early stage dementia, distinct from moderate stage and distinct from advanced stage, and what do people need and what should we be paying attention to and how should we be helping them. This talk today is designed for just general professionals who work with older adults or maybe coming across older adults in their work setting, but may not have a specialized knowledge of dementia. I am assuming some basic knowledge of dementia, but you know, most people, professionals that are working with older adults, don't necessarily specialize in dementia. So I'm talking to people that are working in clinical or community settings, nurses, hospital nurses and staff, senior centers, community health centers, nonprofits. I'm going to present to you the experiences and attitudes, the worries, the needs of people with mild dementia and their family members, so that you can, the aim is that you'll be able to do a few things. You'll be able to pick up on clues in their behavior or in their talking. You'll be able to listen to them deeply and in such a way that you'll really be able to understand them and offer them solid support and direction, or at least know where to refer them to for solid support and direction. I'm going to be talking about the experiences and the needs of the person with dementia as well as family members. And I want to say here that at the end of this program, I have a few slides on local and statewide resources in the Upper Valley and Vermont and New Hampshire, some specifically on early stage programs and some just on resources to refer families to in general. And then the very last slide is my contact information, my phone number and my email. And anyone who's viewing this today in the audience here, or I know that there are people at other sites, or even if you see this in a recorded a lecture, you can email me and I'm happy to send you the PowerPoint presentation so that you don't have to worry about taking notes and getting all the details down. And I'm also happy to share any of the literature that supports this talk. And there's much more than I cite in here. I just didn't want to load up each slide with all of the research that pertains to it. So I'm happy to share any of that if that helps out, so you can just listen and not have to worry about taking down too many detailed notes. So I want to start with just talking about what early stage is and what I mean by that and what's meant by that in the field. Here's a visual of it. I'm sorry that it doesn't come out so clearly when it's projected. But what we're talking about when we talk about early stage, and I'm just going to use this term early stage to cover mild cognitive impairment and mild dementia, the first two arrows there. And on this slide, you also see some of the general criteria that define these phases. Mild cognitive impairment is a measurable but still subjective sense of memory loss or cognitive decline. It doesn't interfere with carrying out daily tasks. And once we move into mild dementia, early stage Alzheimer's, something like that, this is when the cognitive deficits have progressed to actually interfering with or being a hindrance in carrying out daily tasks of living. And that's what we're talking about. So those are the general criteria. But I think it's easier to understand what early stage is from a functional point of view. And this is because this is how people that have the disease or diagnosis and their families actually understand it and work with it and live with it. For them, it's functional. So first, when I'm talking about early stage today, I mean the diagnoses of mild cognitive impairment, or MCI, early stage Alzheimer's, mild Alzheimer's, or mild dementia. Those are all right now included in early stage. They're not interchangeable. Mild cognitive impairment is made before early or mild Alzheimer's or dementia, but they're all in early stage. I do just want to note here that the diagnosis or the term mild cognitive impairment has a lot of ambiguity with it, and there's a little bit of controversy in the field right now, particularly around should this be given as a diagnosis or is it a clinical condition which indicates a higher risk to progress into Alzheimer's. There's a good deal of ambiguity about knowing how many cases of MCI actually progress to Alzheimer's and which ones will. Studies vary widely on this. There are some studies that indicate that a high number of people with MCI will eventually progress to Alzheimer's or dementia. Other studies indicate that there's a significant number that stabilize or even revert. What I've noticed is that MCI that has the sublabel or subcategory of being amnestic MCI is particularly considered to be a preclinical phase or an early phase of progressing to Alzheimer's, but still, there's a bit of controversy over that, but I'm going to include it today because I work with a lot of people with mild cognitive impairment. They're identifying themselves in this whole early stage population, so I think it's really important to include them. So the function of the functional level here, I think, is more easier for us to understand because, as I said, it's how families are living with it and understanding it. Essentially, someone that's in the early stages of Alzheimer's or dementia is still quite autonomous functionally. They're often still driving. They may be still working if they're young enough, or they may be still involved in work or volunteer activities, things that they've always done. What's a really key here is that they're safe to be alone. They don't need any supervision to be alone. We're generally okay leaving them alone, and they can spend time alone. They can perform their ADLs, their activities of daily living, which is basic activities, bathing, dressing, feeding, and their instrumental activities of daily living, they can do with minimal assistance. The instrumental activities are those more complex activities that such as balancing your checkbook or housework or tasks around the house, things like that, more complicated ones that you need, but you still do on a daily level to carry out your daily life. So they might need some minimal assistance with that. Memory cues is a big thing. But again, this is really characterized by they have some cognitive deficits. I'm going to go over their daily struggles with cognitive deficits. But functionally, they're quite autonomous, and they're still out or able to be out and doing a lot with that. So I want to cover some early warning signs first, because a number of you are likely coming across people in your work who have concerns but no diagnosis, either for themselves or someone else. So I just want to quickly cover what some of the early warning signs are so you can confirm people or help them understand that, yes, maybe they do want to seek a diagnosis. So we have here some of the more typical ones. Short-term memory loss is a hallmark presenting symptom of Alzheimer's disease. Alzheimer's disease doesn't always present with that, but quite often or most of the time. There are word recall problems. Misplacing things is really common, or having periods of confusion or disorientation out in places. And I've bolded these last two because these are quite common as well. They can often occur or appear before the more noticeable cognitive symptoms that I just mentioned, but we don't often look for them or understand them in that way. I can't tell you how many families I've worked with that when I've talked about withdrawal from conversations and activities or depression and apathy, how many of them, the majority of them say, oh yes, we noticed that years ago. But that was before, and we didn't think anything of that. And that's because these two early warning signs, there are many other reasons. They're not so clearly cognitive, so we make a lot of other reasons for them. So it's just something to think about. The literature supports this as well. This whole withdrawal, depression and apathy are two of the most common neuropsychiatric symptoms. And depression is linked very early with Alzheimer's. There's a higher prevalence of depression in people, preclinically before they have Alzheimer's. So it's just something to think about and keep in your mind that those are also early warning signs. So once you see some people that have some concerns and you've discussed early warning signs, you may be working with or coming across a family member or a person who's concerned who will be worried about symptoms but have an attitude of why seek diagnosis. People are frightened of this disease for obvious reasons and good reasons, and they often it's a big thing to confront. So sometimes you have to have conversations with people around why seek diagnosis. It's not always just a simple thing of like, yes, you should go do that, and they just go do that. It can be this is a big deal. And people also don't want to frighten or hurt their loved one and what that will do to their loved one. I have been asked outright many times over the years, outright, why do I need to do this? why do we need to do this? Why do we need to deal with this if we don't have an effective pharmacological response to this disease yet? We can't stop it. We can't delay it. So why do we need to do this? So my answer is, yes, I think that you do. I mean, I'm an advocate for this, of course. And aside from just the, say, general ethical fact that people deserve to know what's going on with their body and their health, the first one is it may be something other than dementia. There are many, many reasons that someone can be having cognitive problems or deficits, and it deserves to be checked out. But beyond that, there are other reasons, and I think good reasons, to seek a diagnosis, even if the end result is dementia. It gives people time. They have time to make important legal and financial decisions. They have time to be educated and come up with care plans with people around specific points in the disease that people who work with dementia know are going to come up and likely cause crises if they're not planned for. Driving and long-term living arrangements are two of the biggest, but there are others, so it gives them time to plan. They can recruit professionals and families and friends for a care team around them. So a family that's living with dementia needs to have a number of people around them that support them from different fields with different talents and different resources in order to move through this well and effectively. I don't have it on here, but I also want to mention that also just for when the person, if someone has dementia but they don't seek and never get a diagnosis, if they at some point later for other reasons need to be in the hospital because of other health reasons, the medical staff needs to know that they have dementia. That could be a big problem if they don't have that diagnosis. It's not in their record. Nobody's talking about it, but they actually do have dementia. That's a big thing to consider medically. So just their involvement with other organizations. People need to know that they have this. They'll treat them differently in different ways, make different decisions if they know that they have dementia. This one is really important, and this is a lot of what I do in my work and how we address what people need and what to do with them, is that they can get education on lifestyle strategies to maintain a higher function level longer. That's really our goal with people in early stages, to help them have a quality of life, have a meaningful life, and maintain a higher function level for as long as possible. And there are ways to do that, and they're proven, and they're getting more attention, and I'll be talking about that. So with all of that said, I did pluck out this quote from a study that I think is important, and why this talk today and talking about early stage is important. So considering diagnosis, they say drawbacks may outweigh benefits if people are left with a diagnosis but little else. This is another big hot topic in Alzheimer's and dementia right now, around diagnoses and the ethics of a diagnosis, and what information, level of information helps people, what level of information hurts people, how much can they really understand in the beginning, that type of thing. So that's not my, I don't give diagnoses and it's not my area of expertise, but I am concerned with this, that area of little else, of what do you do? So if people do have a diagnosis, what is the best thing to do with them? And that's what we'll be talking about today. So first, before I talk about what we do, I'm going to talk about what is their life like for an early stage person. I'm going to talk a little bit more here about the ambiguity of mild cognitive impairment. When I first started this work several years ago, I didn't hear a lot about MCI. It was really just discussed in clinical research trials. It was very clinical and research oriented. And now I'm seeing it more and more and more in general practice and daily life, and I'm meeting more and more people with mild cognitive impairment who, again, are identifying themselves as a part of this early stage population. It's a very ambiguous, as I mentioned, it's a very ambiguous state. They just don't know what's going to happen to them, and a lot of people don't know how to explain what's going to happen to them, because, you know, like I said, physicians, clinicians were not exactly clear on who progresses and who doesn't. I ran focus groups, four focus groups this winter here at the Aging Resource Center with early stage people and their partners to get an idea of what their daily life was like, but also to develop programs here for them. And I had several people from MCI participate, and so that was interesting because they identified themselves, because I promoted it as early stage focus groups, and they identified themselves. And they all talked about the difficulty of living with the diagnosis being primarily around their fear of the future. And they were in this state of that of waiting for that proverbial shoe to drop. And this being in that state psychologically can chew up a lot of emotional energy, and it keeps people from being really present and being able to focus on their life. So that's just something to think about if you're working with or coming across someone with MCI. There are specific, ambiguous but very real issues of living with that. So I have listed here the typical cognitive challenges that people in early stage, MCI and mild dementia, talk about in the cognitive realm of what they're challenged with on a daily level. Now, the symptoms, the cognitive symptoms in early stage fluctuate greatly, and that's a known phenomenon of dealing with in the early stage. When you get later into the disease and people are more into it, it's more pronounced and they're more taken by the disease, so to speak. But in the early stages, the symptoms can fluctuate, and they can do very well for a period and then not do well, and it can come and go. That can be really challenging for family members as well as people with it. And if you look at this list here, it really describes a person's general inability to not think as well as they used to. Okay, they can still do it. They can still think. They can still work through things, but they need more time, and it becomes more challenging, and particularly with memory deficits, they may need some more assistance. So this is really frustrating. This creates a high level of frustration for people, because they just can't, you know, they just can't run the TV remote well one day. That's really frustrating, or they can't do things alone as well. Things are left incomplete, or they're just not exactly sure of how to do it. And it also can trigger this overarching fear of the future. Because if they're struggling this much with simple things today, what does that mean? Is it getting worse? Are they noticing if it's getting worse? Are other people noticing if it's getting worse? And they know where this is going. So it can also trigger this overwhelming fear. So those are a list of the cognitive challenges, but someone, the daily life of someone in early stage also involves relational and psychological challenges that are really important to understand. People may not have language for this. These are the context that other things, symptoms are appearing in, and I'll explain that more a little bit later. But do not discount the impact of stigma on someone in early stage, and particularly around issues of disclosure. This is a very big deal. This is a very, very big deal. I talk to people about it a lot. I've recently, just this week, and it's only Wednesday, I've talked to two people about it, and they both had the very common issues of not wanting to be socially engaged, of withdrawing from activities, and not even wanting to disclose their diagnosis to friends, and sometimes even to family members, you know, to extended family members, because they're afraid of how they'll be perceived. They're specifically afraid of looking like or being treated as though they're stupid and being abandoned by people. And so this is very real. It can be very isolating for someone because it's greatly inhibitive of getting them out and being socially engaged, for one, which is important. But it also inhibits them from recruiting help and support from other people, which is really, really important for them to maintain independence. So this is sort of an irony, and this is often how how the conversation goes when I have this with people, is that if your goal is to remain independent longer, you ironically need to take in some assistance or help more, which means you need to disclose. And so there are reasons to disclose. They're different for each person and situation. So for instance, someone may want to disclose to medical professionals if they're going through some other treatment course or something else before they do to, say, an acquaintance that they don't see very often, right? So depending on the situation and the relationship and the person, they may or may not want to disclose right then. But there are reasons to disclose that benefit them. And one is getting help and support to remain independent. And the other is isolation. Isolation is a big deal. It's a big factor in people with dementia and their family members. And so this whole area of disclosure comes up in early stage. And this is, again, this is a series of conversations and talking about what are the benefits and what are the fears and how might you do this. There are changes in family relationships, particularly your most intimate family relationships and spousal relationships. And these are often due to that feared loss of control that's coming up. So people in early stage can be very sensitive to other people making decisions for them or doing too much for them. And the way that I see this in family relationships is typically a very well-intentioned spouse is very worried and frightened. She or he sees how the deficits and symptoms frustrate and hurt their loved one, and they just don't want them to be hurt, and they're just trying to take care of everything and make sure everything's taken care of and everything's safe, and they don't realize that they're being a little bit intrusive or that they're being perceived that way. And so there will be these conflicts back and forth, and one person will be in the position of, I'm just trying to help. And the other one's like, don't treat me like that. Let me do what I want. So often it's just about helping them realize where their new boundaries are. There are new boundaries. One person is crossing over boundaries and one person has stronger boundaries on being helped. And so that's just typically a boundary issue. The discrepancy in perception of values, there's several studies now that I think are interesting that are demonstrating that when they ask a person with dementia to rate their level of values on, say, five regions in their life, and then they ask their caregiver to rate their perception of what the person with dementia's values were on those regions in their life, they consistently underestimate. So even people, family members, spouses, parents, children, even people we know very well, we may not know their perception and their experience of dementia or anything else for that matter. We really do need to ask them. So there's a lot of assumptions that get made in families, like, I know this person. I've known this person my whole life. I know them. I know what they're thinking. I know how they're feeling. I know what they want. And it's really good to check because it's being demonstrated that that's not necessarily the case with this. People with early stage dementia have a lot of worry and guilt over the future, specifically worry and really fear over the loss of control that's coming, and guilt and worry about being a burden to their family. And this is a psychological background to a lot of ways they may be responding to different things in their life. And this is just really about talking it out with them if they're available for that conversation. They're not always, but it's good for us to understand that this is a very heavy situation for them, and there's more going on than we may know around simple decisions. And do not underestimate the initial profound confrontation that an early stage person has with the change in their identity. This is actually huge. So they're trying to negotiate needing and wanting to maintain the self-worth of their former self, of who they've always been, and needing and wanting to adapt to the reality of what the disease is meaning about them and how they need to be different in the world and in their relationships. This does not happen overnight. It is negotiated over time. And it's just a part of what can be influencing their behavior. I'll talk about that in a moment. When you're trying to assist them supportively, these things can be working in the background. So that is what an early stage person's daily life is like. They have cognitive challenges that are very frustrating. They have issues dealing with stigma and fear around disclosure and getting help. And they have changes in relationships, changes in boundaries in relationships, sometimes new conflict in relationships. And they're trying to negotiate this great change in their identity. All the while that this is happening, they're trying to have a good life and have a meaningful life and stay engaged and stay present. And this staying present for the family member and for the person with dementia is a big goal of ours, of someone like me that works in this field. That's a big goal. I'm trying to get them to be present and to be grounded in the presence and develop meaningful activities and meaningful relationships. So what do they need? Considering this experience and what our goal is, they first need to understand their diagnosis and their disease. So again, I mentioned earlier that this is a big topic of debate around diagnosis and how to give it and how much to give. It's not my area of expertise, but I will tell you from being on the receiving end as a clinician and an educator with people and families living with dementia, that very many of them don't really understand their diagnosis, what it is, and what the disease means for them. Okay, so not everybody that's listening to this talk gives diagnoses, so it that may not be your realm either, but I think that something that's important to understand is that in this need to know their diagnosis and their disease, what would really help people is this, is to know what to do next. And if you can just provide that, and if you do nothing else, refer them to the Aging Resource Center, because we do this, we take care of this. I'm here, there are other people here who work with dementia, we're connected to the memory clinic, so we know how to answer this question. That's the work that I do, and we know how to get people for them to answer this question. So they really need to know, okay, I have this diagnosis, I have some general understanding that it's progressive. Now what? What should I be thinking about? What should I be doing? What should my priorities be? What do I not need to worry about? How do I do this? What's the next thing I do? And so sometimes it's just that next thing. So let's talk about that. So you can refer them out, and if your work entails it, you can, for one thing that they need, you can help them with adopting optimal lifestyle strategies. This is to reduce stress and increase function. And basically, the interventions that we work with early stage people, and actually people with dementia at any stage, but is to reduce their stress, because their stress level is often through the roof, or can be. I mean, it's really high. And the more stress they have, the more it exacerbates their symptoms, the worse they do. And you want to increase their function level. As you reduce their stress, as you train them, as you educate them, as they're doing better, physically healthy, they'll be able to have a higher function level longer. And that's their goal, so that they can have a quality life. So how do we do that? These first two, exercise and diet, are, you know, just a staple of the basic lifestyle strategies that we suggest. Exercise is getting a lot of attention. It's received a lot of attention for just older adults in general and the benefits of exercise on brain health. And now it's getting a lot of attention on the benefits of an active lifestyle and reducing the risk, being a real factor in reducing risk of getting Alzheimer's or dementia, and that lifestyle strategies are quite important in this. And it's starting to get attention in research of, well, what does an active lifestyle mean for people that already have the diagnosis in early stage? Will this help to delay or slow down the progression? So exercise, healthy diet, this also reduces stress in other ways. So this is a core of optimal lifestyle strategies for people. Good sleep, social engagement, mental stimulation, so it's really important that people stay engaged in meaningful productivity, in meaningful activities. This can be challenging, not only because we live in a rural environment and, you know, say in the winter it can be hard to get people out. There may not be a lot for people with early stage or a lot that they can do. Stigma can be a problem here. the social engagement for early stage. And then this one is important. They need training in how to adapt to their symptoms to reduce their stress and be able to live more independently and with less stress and frustration. So what I want to couch this in is to remember that there's the psychological context is holding all of this practical work that we do. So this is the core of the practical work that we do with early stage people. But the psychological context of the identity change, of the changes in family relationships because of loss, a fear of loss of control, the stigma, all of these things can be impacting your work. So for instance, if you're trying to train someone or get someone to incorporate an adaptation to a memory deficit or something else, so it's a behavioral adaptation that seems to you rather small and easy, and you're getting resistance, it may be because it's triggering that change in identity that they don't like. That to adapt to this new behavioral symptom or to take on this new adaptation is hitting that issue with identity change. It may be if you want someone to take on a new regimen in exercise, and it's something that they've seemed like or spoken as though they've wanted to do, and you're getting pushback on that, it could be something such as a family member has been harping on them for a while to do exercise, and so they're resisting because they're feeling as though they don't have a choice. It's not their choice. So it could be something like that. And then with social engagement, like I just said, if people often, very often, resist social engagement, they'd probably really like to do it. We know that it'd be good for them. But that fear of disclosure and that stigma is holding them back. So if you're working with people, this is the nuts and bolts of how we work with people, but if you're getting resistance or pushback, or you don't understand why this isn't making sense to people, it may be those psychological triggers, that psychological context is being triggered. And so just have a conversation for that, because often people don't have language for that until you start to tell them, you couch it, you frame it that way for them, and then they say, oh, you know what, you're right. Yeah, I feel as though I don't have a choice here. So you just help them to make the choice or whatever it is, help them disclose, help them negotiate identity and becoming more secure with that. An early stage person needs to retain as much autonomy over their life and their choices as possible. And this is important. This goes back to the boundary stuff. This goes changing boundary issues with family members and others. This goes back to their fear of loss of control that's coming up, and they know it's coming up even if they can't talk about it, which they often can't, don't want to talk about it. They know that it's coming up. So this is important. You know, I work with family members primarily on helping them to relate to their loved one with dementia in such a way that their loved one has as much choice as possible. You know, studies have shown that people even well into the disease, beyond early stage, well into the disease with dementia, still have the ability to show preference and make choices in many areas of their life. You just have to offer it to them. Okay, so that's something that's important and that can be worked out with them and the family, because there are some things that they're not going to have full choice on anymore. So you want to have them be able to have as much choice as possible that's feasible, that's safe, and that's realistic. Early stage people need to maintain their self-worth as they negotiate their identity change. Again, this is big. This is subtle. We don't have a lot of language for it. I rarely have someone tell me that. but they're going through this. I've spoken about the importance of autonomy, meaningful productivity. And this is important for maintaining their self-worth. This is something, frankly, that I struggle with in my work, that families struggle with, is how to keep people meaningfully engaged. Stigma, fear of disclosure, can come up here. But also, people just want to feel like we do, like they've always felt. We want to feel as though the things that we're doing contribute to our family, contribute to our friends, contribute to our community. We want to be involved in things that we enjoy and that matter. So it's really, that's a very important aspect. And then the comfort and security, just having that home base. There's a big fear of abandonment, fear of what this disease is doing to their family. So working with families to make sure that they have as many supports and resources in that area as possible. So we've spoken about here the person with dementia and what their experiences are. They have these cognitive challenges, they have these psychological challenges of family relationships changing, stigma, fear of disclosure, and identity negotiation. So how about the family? What does the family need? The family, two things that go without saying these days are that they need education and support. I say goes without saying, some of you may not be as involved in dementia as I am, but this is everybody in my field, we all know this, and this is what we're doing. And this is, the research well proves it. If caregivers have a combination of education and supportive services, counseling interventions, support groups, resources, coping skills, training on coping skills, all of these things, there's several ways to do it. We do a lot of that work here at the Aging Resource Center. This helps to alleviate depression, it alleviates stress, it alleviates burden, and it's been demonstrated that the better the primary caregiver particularly, but the better the family's doing, the better the person with dementia will do. So that's well known. And if you need some ideas on that, you can contact us and we'll tell you what we're doing and what other people are doing. But when we consider early stage, so families that have a loved one in the early stage, there's something else that they need that you may not know because it doesn't get talked about as much. They need validation and normalizing of some specific unique experiences they have. Now, this experience is so prevalent with the families that I work with and that my colleagues work with that I have given it a name. So you are the first people to hear of this syndrome, and it's, you know, maybe it'll be published one day. But I call it the only I know syndrome. And this is really common with people of early stage individuals. So someone in the changes in early stage dementia and MCI are typically only apparent to their closest family members, to the people that live with them on a daily basis. People with dementia, even further into the disease, can retain these general social programs, you know, general conversations and chatty chat and understand how things work and get a little assistance on the memory from their families. And they can still go out and most people in their life, they're not seeing every day. And this is particularly true for professionals. We don't see these people every day and we don't see them in their environment. They come to our office or our center usually. And so we're not aware of, us and others in the world are not aware of the extent of their deficits. I know this intellectually when I'm talking to them, but I don't see it. So, but the family members are, and particularly the primary caregiver is. And what can happen is that they're noticing all these things, and I'm about to go through specifically some of the things that they notice the most. And if they talk about it to people, it often gets dismissed. And this is important, and I just want you to realize this and understand this so that you can listen to family members of someone in early stage a little differently. They need this validated so that they can work through it. It's a well-known experience, and they'll doubt themselves, they'll feel bad, but it doesn't go away. So here are some of the things that they are really noticing that other people don't notice yet. There's an early breakdown of serial processing. There's this breakdown of just being able to do complex tasks, the TV remote, the microwave, a recipe, mowing the lawn, little things. They'll notice, the family will be noticing this increased frustration and reactiveness. They'll be noticing incomplete tasks or poor decisions on simple things. We don't see that out in the world. They see that. The family is seeing the results of depression and apathy, which are very common. The family is seeing far more memory deficits than we are. Probably people, professionals and other people in the world, what we would notice most are memory deficits, someone repeating something or not remembering what we just said. But the family's really seeing it, is really seeing the level of deficit. And the family is often taking bearing the brunt of an increased sensitivity that someone in early stage has around their deficits. This totally makes sense. I mean, you know, their deficits are bringing up that larger fear, often of loss of control. And so there can be a real emotional reactiveness to little things. And the family's taking that on, and the family is seeing this, but we don't see it out in the world. And so it creates a syndrome of only I know how bad this is, only, and no one else does. And as I said, it often gets dismissed. And so it's something to look for, is something to really validate for families that this is real and you're right, and help them process that. So we want to help them process that, because another thing they need help with is this tendency to what I call swallow the disease whole. Not everybody does this. Some people are just very good at being present and practical and pragmatic and just taking care of what needs to be taken care of. But a number of people, and particularly if it's combined with this only I know experience, in the early stages, they swallow the disease whole. They drown in it. They take the disease in total and everything that it means for them, everything that it means for their loved one, and they can't get out of it. And there's a profound grief that can happen in the early stages. And again, this can get dismissed because we anticipate and we expect the grief more in the advanced stages. And it's there as well, but the grief is throughout the entire process. And the grief response changes with each stage, but it starts with early stage. And again, people don't recognize this, people don't validate this for family members. I'll give you an example. I met a woman about 3 years ago, probably a week after her partner received a diagnosis of early stage Alzheimer's. And to use a clinical term, she was a mess. She had swallowed the disease whole. She was having a profound grief reaction. She was heartbroken. And so her partner was able to, you know, be independent and autonomous and still doing everything that he did. But she was overwhelmed with it. So I worked with her on and off, not steadily throughout the years, but on and off I worked with her. I saw her a month ago. So it's 3 years later. She's dealing with far more now than she was then. So for instance, the driving issue is really coming up, and that's a big one for her. So we were working on that. And I noted to myself and to her in the consultation last month how much better she was doing, but how much worse her practical life was. And she noticed it too. And the reason why is she had negotiated that initial confrontation with the disease. And she had managed it, and that part was over. It's not like she's happy-go-lucky now. She still has strong grief and strong emotions, but she's much more grounded and much more present and able to respond in a practical way to what's actually happening. And again, that presence, bringing people present to deal with things is a big goal of doing that. So this, families need help with that. They need people around them who understand, for one, that that's happening to them, and that it's okay, that it's normal in their situation, and validating it, and then helping them work through that, because that's not something that just happens overnight. That's a negotiation. That happens through a series of conversations and working through your emotions. And then finally, I want to mention here that families, family members, adult children, spouses, also go through changes in roles and identity. Specifically, they go from being the daughter or the son or the wife or the husband to becoming a caregiver. And I'll give you a poignant example. A wife told me recently how her husband, who has Alzheimer's, was introducing her to some people that he had met but she had not met yet, and he introduced her as his caregiver. Now that's just a word, right? It's just one word, but that was a profound moment for her. So sad, so heartbreaking, that's how he was thinking of her and how she was becoming to him. And she could feel it too. So that's a big deal. These things are all big deals to deal with. So I have just a few minutes. So I'm gonna just go through the synopsis here, and then I wanna go through, take a few minutes and go through the resources, what we're doing here at the Aging Resource Center, and then some resources beyond us. Again, so that you don't have to worry about taking all excellent notes for all this information, you can just email me and get the PowerPoint. So as a synopsis, early stage people experience fluctuating, frustrating cognitive symptoms, changes in family relationships, stigma around fear of disclosure, and a confrontation with changes in identity. Early stage people need to reduce stress and increase function level. They need to retain their autonomy, maintain their self-worth, and be engaged in meaningful productivity. Family members need education and support, but they need validation of their unique experiences and assistance with their initial response of grief to the totality of the disease. So the Aging Resource Center, we do a lot here with just aging in general. I do work specifically within dementia here, but there are several other people here who do work with dementia. Bernie does work. Justin Montgomery does some great work with nurses and caregivers. So there's a lot of people doing different things here. Our programs are free to public and families and patients. I think over the years we've maybe had just a few that might have had charges for different reasons, but very, very small ones. We run all different types of education and social programs, support groups. We do a lot of referrals. Early stage specifically, these first two don't happen here at the Aging Resource Center. The Memory Cafe used to. These were the brain children of Dr. Bob Santulli, who's just retired. They're very active. They're being run by a sorority that he worked with at Dartmouth. They happen once a month. The Perspectives is brand new, very popular. You have to register for it because they take a limited number, but once a month on a Saturday morning, early stage people and their partner gather at the Hood Museum and they go around, they're led around by a guide through different parts of the exhibition, and they just talk about the art and just go through the art exhibits. It's wonderful, people love it. People love the Memory Cafe. These last two are some programs that I'm developing and running here specifically for early stage. The first one is a small pilot that's starting in September here. I'm hoping to expand it, but it's essentially I'm working with a professional photographer and we're going to teach early stage people and their partners to take photos. We're going to go through photos and topics in their life and build a collage with them and have a public exhibit. So it's a creative art program that I'm very excited about. And then I'm also developing what I'm calling a memory loss roadmap. I'm hoping to have a pilot running this next spring. The memory loss roadmap is essentially a series of programs trying to address that question that I asked earlier of, or what people, what do I do next? So it's a series of programs that are meant to address that of what should my priorities be? What do I need to do? What do I not need to do? How do I negotiate these changes? How are these changes psychologically that I'm going through in identity, with family, with stigma? How are they impacting my decisions, my ability to do things? So memory loss roadmap is hopefully going to address those. I do want to mention the Alzheimer's Association. I've been representing the Alzheimer's Association here for almost 6 years. This is a fantastic organization. There's a chapter in each state. You have there the 800 number. All of their services are free to patients and families and the public. They offer clinical consultations, education. They're great, and everybody should have their phone number readily available and give it out to every family that you know. I do want to mention these two resources in New Hampshire because we've referred to them quite often. There are more, and I'm sorry I can't get them all in, but ServiceLink is very important. There's their main number. They have an office in every county. And Granite State Independent Living is also statewide, and they offer a high range of services. They're a nonprofit. And if you're in Vermont, if you're listening today in Vermont or you have families in Vermont, they have the SASH offices, which are fantastic, and more are emerging in Vermont. In fact, we just have a new one in Hartford. But rather than list those offices, I'm just listing the 800 number, the Senior Helpline. This is really the place to enter resources in Vermont. It's very comprehensive, it's cohesive, it's a great portal in. It will get you in touch with one of their five area agencies on aging, which are very well structured and resourced, and they do a lot in Vermont. So if you're working with people in Vermont, you can just put them to the Senior Helpline, and that will help them out. So there's my